Today at Reader's Corner, Melissa Jacoby, author of the new book, Unjust Debts, How Our Bankruptcy System Makes America More Unequal. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Bankruptcy is the biggest federal court in America. In theory, bankruptcy in America exists to cancel or restructure debts, a safety valve designed to provide a mechanism for restarting lives and businesses when things really go wrong financially. In her new book, Unjust Debts, legal scholar Melissa Jacoby shows how bankruptcy has also become an escape hatch for powerful individuals, corporations, and governments, contributing to unseen and poorly understood ways to race, gender, and class inequality in America. Across a broad agenda of crucial issues, Unjust Debts reveals the hidden mechanisms by which bankruptcy impacts everything from sexual harassment to healthcare, employment discrimination, the opioid crisis, and gun violence. Melissa Jacoby is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she is a frequent contributor on bankruptcy and debt in national media outlets. Melissa Jacoby, welcome to Reader's Corner.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with the basics. The only thing I know about Chapter 11 and 13 and 7, they were in the last chapters of the book I read, and that's about it. So you're going to have to help us, and I think I have a lot of listeners out there who are in the same boat who hear about bankruptcy. It's never affected them personally, even though I think you mentioned something about 1 out of 10 families have had to deal with it. Let's start with the basics. Begin with maybe a shorthand version of how bankruptcy works in light of the bankruptcy code and those chapters I mentioned.
Well, I appreciate the question because that's why I wrote this book for a general audience. Bankruptcy is affecting us all indirectly and many of us quite directly, whether as a debtor or a creditor. And what the system is supposed to be doing is making the best out of a bad situation. We have a society that puts lots of risks on the household level. People have good ideas and things go wrong in businesses. And sometimes the very powerful tools, the bankruptcy system, can make everybody a little better off, even in a rough situation. So bankruptcy is actually in the Constitution that the federal government can provide a system, and that's something states can't do. And so the most powerful thing that a bankruptcy system can do in America is cancel or modify debt or other legal obligations, even if the other party doesn't agree. And that's something that overrides a lot of other laws. So on the one hand, it is the foundation to the idea of a fresh start for someone who has had unforeseen medical problems, has to take care of other family members, credit cards end up piling up for the necessities, and need a way to make a fresh start. We have business analogies there as well to keep workers employed, to keep supplier relationships. And these are some of the positive things the bankruptcy system can do. But anytime you have such a powerful tool, it can be misused. And we also have seen less commitment to protecting families who get in financial trouble, and maybe too much benefits going to the biggest corporations who are not always using bankruptcy by the book. So the numbers that come up, we don't have to use them, but we mostly are going to talk about 7 and 13 as the kind of bankruptcies that a family would use. Chapter 11 is what a business tries to use if they want to stay in more control and hopefully reorganize, but they can end up in Chapter 7 as well.
So what's the difference between 7 and 13?
For a family, there ends up being a big difference between 7 and 13 in that for Chapter 7, a family discloses everything, what they owe, what they own, often they own very little, what their income is, which is often relatively low at the time that they file. And in a relatively short period of time, perhaps just months, they can get relief from a lot of their obligations. Definitely not all, like a mortgage or a car loan, but they can get relief fairly quickly, assuming they've been honest and have followed the rules. Chapter 13 takes several years, typically 3 to 5 years is what the law says. And in theory, what Chapter 13 does is make it possible to save a home from foreclosure or renegotiate, rework a car loan, pay other creditors over time. The key is, though, that that debt relief doesn't come until the very end, and someone has to have finished all their payments. It's very expensive, and a lot can go wrong in that process. So people who file Chapter 13 often do not get debt relief at the end. They've gotten a breathing spell, because in both chapters, creditors cannot try to collect during the period of bankruptcy. But in terms of the most powerful thing that bankruptcy can do for a family of get them back on their feet financially, when a Chapter 13 plan is dismissed without debt relief, all those debts that they haven't yet paid come springing back with interest and potentially fees, and they're perhaps even worse than they started sometimes.
And why,
so that's a big concern there.
Why is it released? Is that the word you used when you're talking about that 13?
Oh, well, either, I guess we could use those words in a variety of ways. They get protection from their creditors temporarily, but they don't get a permanent debt relief from the system, because that final legal step has not been taken. They need a court to say they made it all the way through the plan. And then something comes into effect that says permanently those debts are no longer collectible. It would violate the law for those creditors to try to collect them. So this is what how Congress, or the drafters of the bankruptcy code, which is basically the main rule book for the bankruptcy system that comes from the federal government, that says that you basically have to finish the plan in order to get that ultimate permanent protection, not from your new creditors, but from the prior creditors.
Right. What you mentioned, Congress. Let's move on to that. There was a 2005 congressional overhaul of the bankruptcy system, and I wonder if you could help our listeners understand just what impact that has on average consumers.
Bankruptcy is often bipartisan, including the major law that we are working with now, which was from 1978. The same is true for 2005, that it was a bipartisan effort, but it's not as happy a story in terms of cost, complexity, and honestly, sort of policy impact. So starting in the early and mid-90s, and perhaps even before, the consumer credit industry was lobbying Congress pretty hard to make bankruptcy harder for financially distressed families to use. And it took quite a few years to get what they were asking for. In the end, it was a legislation that was about 500 pages of new twists and turns. Not all of it was about personal bankruptcy. Some of it was about businesses or other kinds of bankruptcy, but a lot of it was about personal bankruptcy. The message was personal responsibility, and who can argue with that? I certainly can't. The problem is that didn't really match what was actually in the new law. And it really did just make, from start to finish, and even before a case even started, some lawyers would be discouraged from taking these cases at all. So there were fewer lawyers to help people, but people would definitely need a lawyer because the law got even more complicated. And it became harder to get out the other end, especially, well, certainly we've seen that. I was talking before about these repayment plans in Chapter 13. The amount that someone would have to pay in many cases got even larger. And the thing I think that's important to see is that many people view bankruptcy as a sort of, are you in favor of debtors? Are you in favor of creditors? And in addition to the fact that any of us could be in either of those categories, and often are in both in our everyday life, it's not so simple in that often it's creditor versus creditor. And in some of these situations, the beneficiaries of these changes were really not the creditors in any given case, it may be that keeping people out of bankruptcy for longer leads to more fees and more minimum monthly payments being made and the like. I would also say that at the time these amendments were put forward, the consumer credit industry was doing very, very well, and financially distressed customers were some of their most profitable. So even if they did have high default rates, things were going pretty well for them, and they had a way to control that. They knew who their most risky customers were. So those are some of the things that are troubling about the law that still are with us today.
Well, it shows you the enormous impact of the consumer credit lobby. There's no doubt about that. Were there any legitimate concerns about bankruptcy in this case where it was being misused? And that's why they eventually got into it, even though the consumer credit guys in the end got the win.
I think it's extremely important for bankruptcy not just to be fair, but to seem fair to the public. That's important for its legitimacy,
right,
and for its existence. This system needs to be tailored to help people who need it most. The problem is that the horror stories that we sometimes hear about someone who seems very well off, who tries to use the bankruptcy system, they're not the people that this law was targeted toward. I think the biggest effect, and I don't know anyone who disagrees with this, the biggest effect of the law was on the families that are the hardest hit, that don't have the fanciest lawyers and don't have financial planners who could hide assets away in other countries or in special forms. So I would say, yes, we should always be alert to making sure the system is fair to creditors and to society, to the communities. And I've been involved in reform efforts since early in my career that were dedicated to that. But the law might have spoken in those terms, but that's not what it was really aimed toward. That's not where the money is, the big money is for the consumer credit industry. The big money for the consumer credit industry is actually the average financially distressed family.
Today I'm speaking with Melissa Jacoby, author of the new book, Unjust Debts. The book offers an incisive look at the hidden role of bankruptcy in perpetuating inequality in America. So help us with how the law treats corporations as persons and how bankruptcy law then gives corporations breaks that the little guy doesn't get.
So across the law, corporations are treated as people. We've heard that come up during political elections. It certainly comes up in a lot of Supreme Court decisions of the United States. So when we see the word persons in the law, everyone should be alert to the fact that they don't just mean humans. And that's okay. There are really good benefits to the concept of creating a separate entity for someone to start a small business. There can be some protections that come with that. Although people who start small businesses are often asked to put their own assets and promises on the line as well. But what I'm looking at, and it's not unique to bankruptcy, but it's strong in bankruptcy, is when the law is more favorable to big fake people, as I call them, big corporations, even big nonprofits, sometimes cities, than treating humans. And so I give examples of that, such as a corporation can get relief from way more legal obligations than a human can, including debts for willful and malicious injury. Now, that sounds bad, and I get and I support individuals who have done something horrible to someone else. Bankruptcy is not the place to deal with that. But for corporations, they're allowed to shed those responsibilities. The timing of debt relief. So we just went over that for an individual or family in a Chapter 13 repayment plan typically has to wait all the way to the end and finish it, or they don't get debt relief. Corporations in Chapter 11 get debt relief up basically as soon as their plan is confirmed by a court and put into effect, even if they default on that plan, meaning they don't actually follow through. shortly thereafter. They've gotten finality, but their creditors are out of luck. And I've seen that happen in a wide variety of cases. Corporations also have less oversight of their everyday activities, especially the bigger ones relative to humans. We see examples of humans being challenged for all sorts of pretty modest expenses. People really looking at their individual value judgments and choices. And if that's supposed to be the way that bankruptcy is, why isn't that happening with big corporations too, who often are charged or have hired lawyers who bill over $2,000 an hour? That's a heck of a lot of money. That's not for the vast majority of smaller business cases aren't paying their lawyers that much, but the bigger businesses are. But even putting that aside, they've done lots of things that might not have been wise, and they're not subject to the same kind of moral judgment and as well as an actual trustee overseeing what they do. So those are some big differences there.
Let's talk about a couple of examples as to how the corporation, the company, really works against workers and retirees. You cite a case, the Leckie Smokeless Coal Company, that used Chapter 11 to file for bankruptcy. What happened in that case?
The Leckie case is a really good example of companies using Chapter 11 in a way that the drafters that created a system of checks and balances didn't anticipate. So the first thing to know about a case like Leckie is that rather than going all the way through to propose a restructuring and staying in business as the same company, they wanted to use bankruptcy to sell themselves very quickly to someone else. And that leads to a market of investors who want to buy companies in bankruptcy, but don't want to follow all the rules, and they don't want to be subject to all the checks and balances, including creditor voting. So the first thing is they want to sell themselves quickly. And then the second thing is, what are the terms of that sale? So the business is being sold as a going concern, meaning it's still operating. So someone is coming in and wants to buy that business, but how is that going to affect the workers? Well, in cases like Leckie, the buyer says, you know, I don't want to take on all of the obligations that the law imposes on, in this case, coal companies, including obligations under federal law from health benefits for retired coal workers. And an appellate federal court said that's okay, that the law, we can be flexible enough in the law. It's important to let the sale go through. And we're allowed, this company was sold free and clear of those responsibilities to retired coal workers under federal law. And that's not an aberration. It would not be allowed all over the country. There are some parts of the country that would, where the courts probably wouldn't let that happen. But here's another twist, that for big corporations, they have a lot of flexibility about where they go bankrupt. So you could have a company based in Idaho, and they might file in Southern District of Texas in Houston. They might file in Richmond, Virginia, or Manhattan, New York, or Wilmington, Virginia, and file in places where they might be able to use the law more flexibly because these higher courts have been more permissive.
So the Sandy Hook parents filed suit. And again, the Sandy Hook parents, of course, were those whose children were killed by a gunman. They filed suit against Remington, the gun manufacturer. Then what happened?
Well, this is a good, troubling example of, again, how these big bankruptcy cases, bankruptcies of big corporations, are also affecting real people who are claimants. So one thing to see, we just talked about the workers, and now we're looking at a group of people who say this company marketed a deadly weapon in these inappropriate ways. Because bankruptcy law was meant to be so inclusive, it defines debt very broadly. And that includes then grieving families who are doing battle with the Remington company. Now, Remington had already gone through bankruptcy once, but on the, basically the eve of the trial for the Sandy Hook families, they filed for bankruptcy again and did what we were just talking about with the coal company, which is said, we're just going to sell ourselves now. And we've got buyers who want to buy us, and our lenders want this to go very quickly, but everyone says it has to be in bankruptcy and we need to do it super fast, not with all the checks and balances. The Sandy Hook family said, not so fast. What is the rush here? We need to take a closer look at things. But ultimately the sale did go through. The sale was free and clear again of the claims of the Sandy Hook families. And what that means is that even if the company continued to do very well, there would be no responsibility to those families. Now, I want to be clear here that companies sometimes can be sold to someone who doesn't have responsibility. That's a matter of state law, typically, to say when a buyer of a company or a buyer of an asset is responsible for all the liabilities of the seller. And I believe state law has a really important role to play here. So here's an example where federal law is encroaching on that and saying, we're going to override whatever state law would have said. Now, the end for the Sandy Hook families, while this did not go the way that they had asked, they did ultimately reach an agreement with insurance companies for the Remington company. But that's not always going to happen. There just happened to be an insurance policy that could potentially be used for that purpose and still had value left in it. Ultimately, at the end of the day, they did get some compensation. They did not get their day in court. They did not get to do all of the things that they might have otherwise done because there was there the process really made that futile.
So how do cities use the bankruptcy law to avoid responsibility for, let's say, police misconduct?
It probably surprises people that a government can file for bankruptcy and countries cannot file for bankruptcies and states can't, but cities can. And that's been true since the 1930s, but the law really expanded in the 1970s. Everyone was worried that New York City was going to implode and something needed to be done to help them. Now, New York never did file for bankruptcy, but say the city of Detroit did, and quite a few cities in California. And there's a case I'm watching outside of Philadelphia on the East Coast called City of Chester that's in bankruptcy now. Like I was saying about workers and injured people, the bankruptcy system defines claims and debts really, really broadly. So you wouldn't think of it on an everyday basis as a debt. I think of credit cards or bank loans. These are serious allegations of harm, such as someone's saying they were brutalized by the police and their constitutional rights were violated. That counts as a debt. That counts as a claim in a bankruptcy. So injured residents all are put in this box that is very unexpected. And what has tended to happen is they don't have a lot of leverage negotiating position in these cases, because these cases are generally designed to try to strike a deal with as many bondholders as possible, the holders of municipal bonds, workers about their pensions and their health care. And one tricky thing about Chapter 11 that is especially notable and attractive to cities and corporations is you can change the rights of claimants without their consent, as long as you can get a majority of those who vote. And majority is measured a couple different ways, but we're basically talking about some claimants are just going to be left out of the negotiations, but their rights are going to be changed anyway. So the pattern we've seen is that people who have alleged their civil rights have been violated, or frankly, have been run over by a city bus or some other type harm, they're getting the lowest compensation of any kind of claimant in these cases. They are sometimes losing the rights to still have a trial with police officers or other third parties. And It's more than money here because they've also just lost the right to pursue their claims in a court. Instead, it usually has to be dealt with another way. But some of these cases have ended up with truly cents on the dollar. And City of Chester is proposing 0 cents on the dollar. So people will get no compensation unless there's some insurance to help them. And I know all these details can be complicated, but the bottom line is that these cases affect all of us and yet are hidden behind all of this complexity. But thinking about claimants very broadly, and that it could be you or someone that you love who has been harmed, that may be left out of these negotiations, lose their day in court, and not get very much compensation.
I know the last chapter of your book reviews what the possible remedies to this might be. We certainly don't have time to cover all of that, but I wonder if you could just give us a couple of examples of quick fixes, although they might not be quick if they have to go through Congress and they're confronted by a lobby like the consumer credit folks. But perhaps you can just share with us that. And if you could also comment on the recent Supreme Court decision that I guess blocked bankruptcy from moving forward regarding OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma.
Let me take that second question first about Purdue Pharma. I know that's been on some people's minds because it has gotten a lot of mainstream media attention. The Purdue Pharma case before the Supreme Court presented the court with a narrow issue, but that one that has been festering really for decades, which is if a company files for bankruptcy, can it force claimants to also lose their rights against third parties who are not in bankruptcy? And in this case, the company was Purdue Pharma, and those third parties were members of the Sackler family, who not only owned Purdue Pharma, but were actively involved in creating the opioid crisis through their aggressive and allegedly and sometimes admittedly fraudulent marketing of these products. The Supreme Court decided this issue on a statutory interpretation basis and basically said that bankruptcy law does not authorize protection of the Sacklers under these circumstances. People can agree to release the Sacklers and say, I'm willing to settle with them, but they can't be forced in the same way they can be forced to lose their rights against the company that filed for bankruptcy. Now, depending on whom you ask, people will say, oh, the sky will fall, this changes everything. But frankly, in lots of parts of the country, you already couldn't do what Purdue Pharma was trying to do. So it did change the law in some parts of the country. And it means that the leverage in those cases has shifted to say, we need to do more to educate people about why they'd want to strike a settlement with the Sacklers, and need to make sure they know what they're giving up and what they're getting if they do that. And I'll end with a plea for the concept of federalism, respecting state law, and also just the rule of law generally, the flexibility that's being exercised on the big business side and sometimes big cities, although again, that's rarer, is regressive. And it doesn't serve the purposes for which a national bankruptcy system should. This is a coercive federal power being exercised. So those who are concerned about individual rights, protecting state rights, estates' rights to set their own policy and the like, should be concerned about bankruptcy encroaching there.
And for the rest of the story, you can read Melissa B. Jacoby's book, Unjust Debts, How Our Bankruptcy System Makes America More Unequal. Melissa, thanks for writing this book, and thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you for reading it, and thank you for this conversation.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the issues and ideas that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
What happens in Washington? The NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.